All right, I have a few scriptures that I'd like for somebody to look up for us. Matthew 6, 19 through 21.
Matthew 6, 19 through 21.
Matthew 5, 11 and 12.
Matthew 5, 11 and 12.
Hebrews 11, 36 through 38.
Hebrews 11, 36 through 38.
Job 1, 20 through 21.
Job 1, 20.
Matthew 6, 35 through 37.
Matthew 6, 35 through 37.
Matthew 26, 63 and 64.
Matthew 26, 63 and 64.
Exodus chapter 20, verse 7.
Exodus 20, verse 7.
Hebrews 9, 27.
Hebrews 9, 27.
Psalm 126, verse 5.
Psalm 126, 5.
Philippians 1, 12.
Philippians 1, 12.
Romans 8, 28.
Romans 8, 28.
John 17, 17.
John 17, 17.
All right, thank you so much. We're in chapter 5 of the book of James tonight, and we begin with verse 1, which states, "Come now, you rich, weep, howl for your miseries which are coming upon you." Our first question is, how does this verse tie in with the last part of the previous chapter? In the last five verses of the previous chapter, James has talked about those who say, we're going to plan to go into the city, we're going to make a profit, we're going to carry on business. And he's saying, well, all right, but when you make your plans, there's something you ought always to keep in mind. What was that?
The Lord's will.
The Lord's will, right. So he emphasized that. Nothing wrong with planning. Nothing wrong with making a profit. But make sure that whatever you do, you recognize that our days are numbered, and things could very easily change, so make sure that your prayers are always in harmony with the Lord's will. Now, as he continues on in chapter 5 tonight, he is talking about people who have made a profit, and particularly he's talking about rich landowners and their relationship to the people who are working for them. So the first 5 or 6 verses of this chapter are really a carryover of the last 5 verses of the previous chapter, when it talks about our relationship with other people and the handling of funds and the way in which we treat one another on a day-to-day basis. I think that in these first few verses of this chapter we're looking at tonight, he wants us to understand that everything that you get of this world's goods, ultimately, will mean absolutely nothing. It's kind of like the old phrase you often hear, you can't take it with you. The things that we have of material possessions will ultimately all come to naught. And I think he also wants to point out that those who possess many riches face a very serious challenge in that they will let the riches stand between them and the riches they ought to have in the bank of heaven. So this is his primary thrust in these first few verses that we're looking at. Now, he uses an interesting word here. Why does James tell the rich to weep and howl for the miseries they will experience? Obviously, they don't see any reason to weep and howl right now. But there's coming a day that they will weep and howl because they have lived in the lap of luxury now and not been concerned about their fellow man. And the Lord has often dealt with that in his teaching while here upon this earth and in some of the parables he tells. We'll note one in just a moment. What does howling add to weeping? Yes, it does. It's giving strong emotional feeling to their wailing. They are weeping, and it's not just crying silently. Everyone hears you crying, You sound like a person that's shrieking. You're being terrorized. You're beside yourself. And he said, now, you may not experience that now, but notice the last part of this verse, which are coming upon you. You don't think that you're going to face any miserable experiences. Let me tell you, Jesus is saying through James, yes, you are. And let me warn you now that that day is coming. Now, when we talk about miseries, we're talking about hardships and sufferings and distresses. And I think, again, in light of what he's saying here, that these miseries that are going to be yours are not necessarily yours right here and now. But that day is coming. Now, obviously, some people who are very rich in this world's goods see that day coming while they're still living, and they die a miserable death. And chances are you've read stories and heard people talk about the way some wealthy people have died that help you to understand exactly what is being talked about here. I understand that in London, England, in one of the cathedrals there, if you've ever been to London and looked around the cathedrals, you'll know that there are a lot of burial places, not only around the building itself, but sometimes in the building. And if you go into Westminster Abbey, you're stepping on top of stones that have etched out or have placed there in brass plaques that beneath here is where so-and-so has been buried. David Livingstone comes to my mind when I walked into that building the first time and looked down and saw, wow, so this is where he was buried, right where I was standing. But there are often burial places all around closely associated with these cathedrals. In one such burial place, in one of these cathedrals, there is an epitaph. And the epitaph simply reads, most miserable. And it was put there by the express desire of the person who paid enough money to be able to have his burial in that particular spot. But he was honest enough with himself to recognize that even though he's being buried there, he knows that the future is not bright for him. That's pretty sad. When a person knows that, if they're still living and breathing, they ought to do something about it and plead for God's mercy to help them. Now, to tie all this together, I've asked question number 5. Does the rich man that Luke speaks of in Luke 16 shed any light on this verse? What is the story that Jesus tells of the rich man in Luke chapter 16? Anybody know? How did he gain his riches? He had a bumper crop. And because he had so much return in his crops, he saw that he had a need. What kind of a need did he have?
More storage space.
That's right. Need more storage place. So what was his thought that came to his mind that led to his action with this dilemma? Yeah. I'm going to tear down old barns. Going to build new ones. I'm going to fill them up, and then I'm going to say to myself, be an Epicurean. What's an Epicurean? A person who eats, drinks, and is merry, because he knows he's going to die. And for them, death ends it all. The only life there is what you live here upon the earth. Well, in that story that Jesus tells of the rich man, he doesn't tell us the name of the rich man, but he introduces another man that the rich man knew something about. Who was that other man? Lazarus. Now, what was the status of Lazarus? Yeah, he's a beggar. And what else can you tell me about him? I'm sorry?
He left God.
Yes. And? He was barely staying alive, wasn't he? Feeding off the crumbs that fell from the rich man's table, had sores on his body, no medical attention, just depended upon the dogs to lick the sores, and perhaps that gave some help, I don't know. But at least the thing that we do know is that the different lifestyles of these two individuals was a tremendous contrast. Hard to not to see the distinction between them. Hard not to see, yeah, that there is a great distinction between them. And so, when they died, where was Lazarus? Yes, and where was the rich man? Yeah, he was in Hades. He was in torment. Now, a gulf separated him from the beggar. But according to the way Jesus related the story, could the beggar now see that Lazarus was pretty well off? Yes, he could. And did he make a plea? For what?
Water.
Yeah. Dip the tip of your finger in water and touch my tongue. That would help so much. Yes, sir. Oh, you're just going to answer that, right. Now, I've really kind of woven two stories together here. I talked about the rich man with a bumper crop that God called a fool. And then I talked about the rich man in Luke chapter 16, in which another person is named, and that is the beggar. But, you know, he was in torment. And God made that very clear. Now, why do you think God wants us to know that?
Don't let the vain riches of this world sway you and attract you.
Yeah. Are not riches deceptive?
Don't want to worship the riches and what it brings.
Obviously, James is underscoring what Jesus had already made very clear in his own teaching. And so, you can have everything that money can buy, but one of these days, that's going to mean absolutely nothing. Now, number six, how are we to understand weep and howl? Yeah. In other words, he says, I want you to see the future clearly enough to realize that if you don't change your lifestyle, you might as well start crying right now. And you might cry out in desperation. And maybe somebody will come to your help. But otherwise, your future is very bleak. Now, is money a blessing or a curse? Both, isn't it? Depends upon whether you have the money or the money has you. Isn't that usually what it amounts to? Can be a tremendous blessing. Can you give me the names of any men in the Bible for whom their riches was a blessing?
Joseph.
Who?
Joseph, the one who buried Jesus.
A good example, Joseph of Arimathea. And that's a fulfillment of prophecy. It was prophesied of old that when Jesus was dead, he would be buried in the rich man's tomb. And he was.
Joseph, he was second command of Egypt. He was rich. He wanted to
be first family of mothers. Oh, obviously. That's exactly right. So there's two men by the name of Joseph, one in the New Testament, one in the Old Testament.
Solomon.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that Solomon is a real good example of this. Yeah. He did come to his senses before he died, didn't he? Before he laid his pen down for the last time, having written the book of Ecclesiastes, he said, let's hear the conclusion. And he said, he commented upon, hey, my quest for riches and to fulfill my lusts, it's just not there. It's all vain. But he said the conclusion is, fear God and keep his commandments. That's the whole responsibility of man.
Job.
Who?
Job.
Oh, my, yes.
Rich, poor, and rich again.
Yeah, and we'll say more about Job in a moment because James is going to bring his name into the conversation here. So there are several examples. I think of Barnabas as one who had real estate and sold it so there'd be nobody that had any need among them. That fourth chapter of Acts that talks about the compassion that the early Christians had for the needy and they sold their goods and distributed among the poor. I like that phrase that says, there was not a needy one among them. Now that's a real tribute to our Christian faith. When those in our number, those a part of our family, the family of God, have need, we rise together to meet that need. I received a letter today from a church in Indiana, actually from the preacher of the church in Indiana, rejoicing in their recent Faith Promise rally. They committed, I recall correctly, about $169,000 in their Faith Promise for this coming year. And considering the economic conditions of their membership, they were very pleased with that demonstration of faith. But he said in the celebration of the Lord's Day, in which the people made commitments, they included in their program a 15-minute video presentation. I think it was called The Harvest, and the farmer had died just before they harvested the crops. Have any of you seen that?
Yes.
Has it been shown here?
Yes.
That's good. Well, I thought that was a beautiful testimony of the way other people came in and rallied and said, hey, you've lost your man and the home, but we'll bring in everyone to harvest your crops and feed you and everything. Made me want to see it the way he described it to me. Said it was really a moving picture. And I just think you like to hear that kind of news, don't you? That we do care about one another. And we're obviously wanting to use what God has blessed us with to meet the needs of others.
Glenn, don't you kind of wish that the story of Matthew had been expounded on a little bit? Because he was a tax collector. He obviously would think he would have been wealthy because of the income that the tax collectors had and the reputation they had. It would be real interesting if Scripture had told us his story. At least I've wondered about that.
Yeah. You'd like to think that he came to his senses and did like Zacchaeus did, who was also a tax collector. Yeah. So, is money a way in which our faith in God is tested? I think it is. I think that people that pray for a stronger faith may not like the way God answers their prayer. God may be saying to them, I'm testing your faith right now. You're robbing me. Why are you doing that? What do you think I've given this to you? So you can live an easy lifestyle? That's not the reason I'm blessing your life. I've given you this so you can enjoy sharing with others and meeting their need. Well, I'm not sure I can do that. Oh, I thought you wanted a deeper faith. Why don't you trust me? Who do you think made that possible for you to begin with? You know, so I think that especially when I think of Faith Promise, I think of the 8th chapter of 2 Corinthians, which I think is the biblical definition of faith promise. Paul was just thrilled to tell the people in Corinth about the giving of the churches in Macedonia. He said they gave beyond their ability. Wow, that's pretty good. Now you know the tithe is their ability, otherwise God would not have commanded it. He doesn't ask us to do anything that we can't do. So beyond that would be, I think that's where faith really comes in. Not only doing what we're supposed to and what we're able to do, but doing beyond that by really trusting in God. Well, faith is put to the test in our individual lives, if we'd only realize it. Would somebody read verses 2 and 3, please?
Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is the last days that you have stored up your treasures, stored up your treasures.
Okay, how do we explain these examples of riches? What is one example of riches that we've just read in these two verses?
Gold.
What's another example?
Personal possessions.
Yeah, the clothes that you have, your wardrobe. Now, in Bible days, usually riches were determined by the amount of gems you owned, whether it be silver or gold or something like that, by the wardrobe that you had, by the food that you had stored up for you. So grain and garments and precious stones were usually the way they determined their wealth in that day. Now all these things are going to be of no value unless they are used in the way in which God intends for them to be used. When I read a verse like this, I'm reminded of my first trip to India. Art Morris was the missionary living there at that time. And he said, I've just got to show you something here in the city of Madras. He said, it'll break your heart, but you need to see it. Are you familiar with CROP, C-R-O-P? That's an anachronism for Christian Rural Overseas. What's the P stand for? Program, yeah. Christian Rural Overseas Program. Now, this is a program that really was a challenge to the farmers. And I know there are a lot of farmers in Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio, in that particular area, that participate every year in the CROP program. They would send the grain to India to help the needy people there. And Art Morris told me that for a number of years, he had the privilege of distributing all the grain that the farmers in America sent over to meet the needs of the people in India. But he said the government stepped in. And now they're the ones that disperse the grain that's sent by a CROP. So he took Carolyn and me down to a warehouse and showed us inside the warehouse, which was filled with grain being eaten by the rats. And the thing that made that day a particularly important visit that I'll never forget is right outside on the street in front of that warehouse was a man that literally was in skin and bones, begging for anything to eat to stay alive. And Art said, when I was in charge of this, this would never have happened. But the government's taken over. And I think that happens all too often. Folks, I hope that the government never becomes a substitute for what God gave the church to do. And I hope we in the church will not let that happen. And there needs to be a compassion, there needs to be an expression of joy and sharing with other people. All right, number two, how did Jesus address the same issue in the Sermon on the Mount? Would you read Matthew 6, 19 through 21?
Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasures in heaven where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal.
Verse 20.
For where 21. Your treasure is, there your heart will be.
Yeah, I guess that's 21, yeah. Thank you. Powerful passage. And there it is. That's what Jesus is urging us to do, and it remains for us then to do it. Now, what man in the Bible was stoned to death because he stole a Babylonian garment? Achan. Where did he get this Babylonian garment? I'm sorry?
Ai.
No. Ai enters the picture. Jericho. Yeah. And why did God say, don't loot the city of Jericho?
It was supposed to be for the all the plunder was to be for the temple, for the nation, religious leaders. Nothing was supposed to be personal gain.
Well, yeah, the primary thing was, you didn't win this battle. God won the battle. So don't think that you have anything coming to you. You just rejoice that you gained the victory because God gave you the victory. Because what'd they do to get the victory?
Marched around the city.
Once every day, seven times in the seventh day, gave glory to God and shouted out, blew the trumpets, and the walls came tumbling down. Now, you didn't do this. God did it. You're there just to witness what God has done. But what happened as a result of Achan taking this Babylonian garment, he also stole some silver and gold. Now the story of Ai comes in. After they conquered Jericho, they had another city to conquer. That's the city of Ai. To say, to spell it is to say it. Just two letters, Ai. And they thought, we don't need as many men. That will be an easy job for us after having conquered Jericho. But they lost 36 men. Their lives were lost.
They didn't ask for guidance from God. They thought they could do it on their own, and they got whooped.
That's true. And also because God will not bless a people that entertain sin in the camp.
Yeah.
And he said, you've got to deal with this sin. And that's why Achan died. But not only Achan, his whole family. He tried to hide it in the floor of his tent. But you cannot hide anything from God. When will the folly of earthly riches be fully realized? All right, on the day of judgment. Now, what are the last days as James describes them in this verse? When are these last days that we determine what the day of judgment is going to be like? All the way through the New Testament, the phrase the last days refers to what?
Church age.
Church age, right. Began on the day of Pentecost. It continues until the Lord returns. So he's concerned about our behavior right now, where we are living. How are we dealing with what we have? I wonder how many people in the church would be happy to say, I'll be glad for anyone to look at my checkbook if you want verification of the fact that I'm laying up my treasures in the bank of heaven. Now, I'm not suggesting you do that. Nor am I suggesting you have any business asking anybody to ask you to do that. But we ought not to be ashamed to do it, should we? If we're actually doing what we ought to be doing, we ought not ever to be embarrassed for people to know how we spend our money. We're not spending it on ourselves. We're spending it for the Lord's work in heaven. Now, one of the things that interests me here caused me to ask this sixth question. Do gold and silver rust?
Silver tarnishes.
Okay. But it talks about rust. What do you? How do you explain that? Does the Bible make a mistake here, you think? Corrodes, yeah. Some people said that's rust is not a good English word to translate this. Corrode would be a better word. Supposing that the word rust is the best English word that we have for this particular Greek statement here, how would you explain this?
Well, it's not being used. If it's being used, it won't get the tarnish and stuff. If it's being set aside, not used, not invested, not given to help, whatever, then just the fact that it's piled up, it's not a tarnish or weather.
It's not worth anything that just sits.
It isn't.
Yeah.
Put it to work.
It's like the wheat and the oats that you saw. Might as well let the rats eat it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I personally view this as hyperbole. What's hyperbole?
An exaggeration,
right. It's the kind of thing that a parent says to the child, if I told you once, I've told you a million times, don't you do this? Had they really said that a million times? No. Probably not even 1,000 times, but they say a million times. And they're not lying, they're using hyperbole.
Depends on the kid.
The purpose of hyperbole is to make a point, and I think that's the thing that causes James to use the language he uses here. Well, what is the only investment man can make that will carry him into eternity with God? The investment in the bank of heaven, the investment in doing what God wants us to do, laying up for ourselves treasures in heaven. And we do that by laying aside each Lord's Day and more often than that as we have opportunity to help further the cause of Christ. Would you read verse 4, please?
Behold the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth.
All right. And that last word is really Sabaoth. This is not the seventh day of the week. This is not the Sabbath day as we think of it. This is Sabaoth. Talk about that in a moment. Is James expressing special concern for those who have made themselves rich by taking advantage of others? Yes, he is. Now, in Bible days, they were paid on a daily basis. So the picture I see that James is painting here is this rich landowner. He's got these slaves working for him, and they worked hard all day long. And they come for their pay, and he said, well, I'm just not going to pay you today. Wow. Where am I supposed to get money to buy food? Where am I supposed to get money to buy the clothes that I need? I work for it. I deserve to be paid. Yeah, but I'm not going to pay you today. Can the rich take advantage of the poor in a situation like that? Yes, they can. And often they do. And that's exactly the kind of picture that James is pointing out here. Now, who is the Lord of Sabaoth? The word Sabaoth literally means the host, the Lord of hosts, or the Lord of the universe. The Lord who controls the sun and the moon and the stars. The Lord who made everything. And so he's talking here particularly about the Lord who owes it all. He says, this has reached the ears of the Lord that knows everything that's going on in the universe. And you do not hide from God. You may think you have, but nobody hides from God. God knows everything that's going on all the time, everywhere, in the heart of each one of us. Now, does the Bible condemn wealth? No, it does not. And this is the thing that we have to be very careful about when we talk about what the Bible teaches concerning money. Money is a real serious challenge to a lot of people. However, when I think of Zacchaeus, we mentioned his name a while ago in connection when the question was asked about Matthew, the tax collector. Here's a tax collector. And when the Lord talked to him, he ended up by saying, well, I'll give half what I've got to share with other people. And he said, if I've defrauded anybody, I've taken something I didn't have a right to take, I'll restore that person fourfold. In the 12th chapter of the book of Romans, there's a list of some of the spiritual gifts that we have, and one of those gifts is the gift of liberality. And there are some people that just naturally are talented in a way, and circumstances have worked out where they come into a lot of money. And thank God that there are men like Leroy Tulock and others that have had a lot of money pass through their hands, and it passes right into the kingdom's work. And they use it to build churches and to save souls and to meet the needs of others. And so it's wonderful that some people have the gift of liberality. And so the Bible does not condemn anybody that's rich. We should not think that a rich person, we should bow down to them because they're rich. No, they just happen to have that particular blessing of God. And it's kind of like the scriptures, too much is given what? Much is required. So God doesn't expect us to do as much as the other person if we're not able to do as much as the other person. But he does expect every one of us to do exactly what we can do. All right, he continues on this same line with verse 5. Would you read that, please?
You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wants and pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in the day of slaughter.
Okay, what is luxurious living? Do you think that anybody in our country today lives luxuriously? Do you think that there are very many people in our country today who do not live luxuriously? Do you not think that most of us here tonight probably would be considered wealthy by much of the world's population? So how do you describe luxury? What is a luxury? Exactly. More than what you need. Now, where do you go to find out that you have more than what you need? What about Haiti? Would that be a good place to start? Or Honduras? Or India? A lot of places. We need to heed this. You have lived in luxury on the earth. I dare say that every one of us have more than what we need. We buy all the latest gadgets. We try to keep up with our next door neighbors and have nicely furnished homes. And we keep trading old things in for new things. Now, I'm not sitting in judgment on anyone. I'm preaching to myself as much as anybody else. We have to be very careful that we do not let luxury dominate our relationship with God and with other people. He says, you have lived luxuriously on the earth. Now he says something else to further define this. In addition to luxury, the thing that goes along with it is wanton pleasure. Do you know what wanton pleasure is? Yeah? It's what?
Want more than what you have, even though you have a lot.
Yes, that's exactly right. Really, involved in that word is the word wasteful. A good example of wanton pleasure is the prodigal son. And when he went into the far country, what does the Bible say that Jesus said in the parable that he did with what he had?
He
Squandered it. What does squandered mean? Is that not wasting it? Wasting it on riotous living? Finally ended up in the pig pen. That brought him to his senses. He came back home. But I talked to a member of the church. This has been years ago. That was wanting to borrow some money for his business. And there was a lady of some wealth in our congregation said, she's got plenty of money to loan me, but she won't loan me any money. And he was really down on her. And I said, now wait a minute. What she does is her business. And what you do is your business. But has it ever occurred to you that maybe the reason she hasn't loaned you any money is because she sees the way you're spending the money you already have? He said, what do you mean? I said, do you want me to tell you? He said, yes, I do. And I began to name the things that he's purchased that he didn't need at all. Just throwing money away. He drank pop like it was going out of style. Now, folks, you can drink water. I mean, you can. You really can. And this is back in the days when you didn't have to pay for your water. This buying water in a bottle, this blows my mind. And I think, why are we doing this? And we just develop habits, don't we? And this same fellow I was talking to, he said, just maybe she's observed how much money you're spending on cigarettes. I never will forget that day in St. Peter's, Missouri. I was holding a revival meeting there, and the preacher took me out calling one day, and a lady, and he said, I think I need to tell you before we go in the house, it's going to be filled with smoke. She has a cigarette going all the time. I said, okay, this has got to be a quick call, because that makes me pretty sick. I said, by the way, do you know her well enough to know whether I can talk to her about that? He said, oh yeah, I can talk to her about it. I said, good. So I walked in there, and boy, we didn't get the conversation going very long. I said, ma'am, how long you been smoking? She told me, how many years? I wrote that down, a little piece of paper. I said, how many packs of cigarette do you smoke every day? And she told me how many packs of cigarettes she smoked every day. I said, now don't get me wrong, I'm not thinking about buying any, but how much is a pack of cigarettes? So I copied that down too. So then I multiplied how much money it costs for a pack, how many packs she smoked a day, how many years she's been smoking. I said, I need to ask you one more question. Is your house paid for? She said, no. I said, is it half paid for? She said, yeah. I said, if you hadn't smoked, it had been paid for completely. I said, you've already burned half of your house down. Just gone up and smoke. Now, would I be inclined to want to help that woman by giving her more money? Not that way. Now, folks, this is the thing I think you have to be careful about when people on the street bum for money. You need to make sure what they're going to use that money for. If they're going to go in and boost it up, and they're going to waste it. I remember we had a lady in the church in Southern Illinois. Well, I should say a family in the church. And they really were in bad shape, and I knew it. And I thought, well, we need to help them. But I didn't want them to become dependent upon us. But I knew where they bought their groceries. So I went to the fellow that owned the grocery store where they bought their groceries, and I said, I'm going to give you some money. And I want you to use this money to buy groceries for this family. And he was a member of our church. He knew who the family was. And I said, don't you tell them who gave you this money. Just simply say that some Christians have been concerned about your well-being. I said, I have a sneaking feeling that when they buy groceries from you, they buy junk food. He said, you're exactly right. I said, I want you to buy any junk food. Buy what's going to contribute to their well-being, their health. He said, thank you. He said, it just breaks my heart when I take money from them to see what they've spent their money on. Stuff that is not really good for them. When they could spend the same amount of money for things that would be good for them, and it'd probably go a whole lot further. Yes?
Glenn, I think one thing we forget when we talk about wine and pleasure and so forth, I think we forget that we also owe God time.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. Time, talent, treasure, all of it's a part of our stewardship. In fact, every day we ought to pray, God, help me to be faithful with the stewardship you've entrusted to me. Don't let me waste another day. Don't let me waste my talent on things that are not worth it. Yeah, you're exactly right. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Number three, what man in Daniel's day fits the description of this verse? Who? Yes, he does. I think that there's another man in Daniel's day that also fits this description. Who would that be? Do you remember the story where a hand was seen writing on the wall? Who was that fellow?
Belshazzar.
He was scared to death, wasn't he? Do you know what he was celebrating when the hand was writing some words on the wall?
How well off he was.
That's right. Man, we've got it. We're safe, we're secure, we're wealthy, we're powerful. We've got it all. And the handwriting said, no, you don't. But he couldn't understand that handwriting on the wall, but it sure got his attention. And all of his wise men couldn't explain it either. But fortunately, somebody was present and said to him, I know somebody who can tell you what that means. Daniel. Daniel explained it to him. Yes, he did. And you know what Belshazzar wanted to do? Man, because you've done this, I'll give you half my kingdom. He said, you don't have it to give. You don't have a kingdom. Well, I'll make you next to me. You're not going to be around. I can't be next to you. I mean, you're gone. You're out of here. This is the end. At the very moment that they were celebrating the security, the Medo-Persian power had already finished digging a ditch so they could channel the water of the Euphrates in another direction. That dried up the riverbed that went under the walls, two walls, that surrounded the city of
Babylon.
Yeah, I couldn't think of the word, Babylon. And so they could go under the walls and the moat. They didn't have to cross any water. The water was gone. It flowed on down the river. So they made a surprise attack. They weren't expecting anything like that. They just knew they had these big walls around the city, and they had 200 towers around the walls, and they were all manned with guards. And so the 1 million people that lived inside the city, they were secure. And he was meeting with all of his nobles and really winding it up and using the sacred vessels that had been taken out of the temple in Jerusalem when they had conquered that city during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, desecrating the things that were intended for a holy use. All came to an end. I tell you, I think that really helps us to understand this kind of thing had happened before James ever wrote this, and certainly it happens many times since then. Verse 6, please.
You have condemned and put to death the righteous man who does not resist you.
Now, does this verse speak of the extreme measures one will take to gain riches? Yeah. You'll condemn, you'll put to death the righteous man? Wow. Now, what record in the Old Testament illustrates that this kind of thing does happen? Think about Naboth. What did he have that Ahab wanted?
A vineyard.
And it was located right where Ahab wanted it to be located. And so he went to Naboth and said, what do you take for your vineyard? Well, I won't take anything for it. It's been in the family too long. It's not for sale. Well, everyone has his price. No, not me. So he went home, and what did he do when he got home? What did Ahab do when he got home?
Pouted.
Who saw him pouting? So she took matters in her own hands, didn't she? So she hired a couple of worthless guys, and they lied about Naboth, and as a result of the lies that they told, they convinced some people that Naboth needed to die because of what the stories they told about him. So with him out of the way, Jezebel was able to say, hey, he's dead now. You might as well take the property. It's yours. Pretty sad. That's the rich and the powerful taking advantage of other people. James has addressed fraud and now speaks of murder. Does he explain how the rich murder the righteous? Well, he doesn't. But I imagine there are a number of ways in which the rich end up murdering the righteous people. Maybe through judicial action in courts. But it happens.
Sometimes that's called the golden rule. Those who have the gold make the rule.
Okay. Now, why don't the righteous resist? Does that surprise you in this verse? That the righteous do not resist. Why don't they resist?
Is it one of the
They're looking at the end picture, maybe.
Well, I'd like to think that that's true. And that may be true. It occurs to me that sometimes they may be in a position where they're not able to resist. It also occurs to me that they might be taking very seriously the example that Jesus set. When he was reviled, did he return in kind? No. Did Jesus allow people to mistreat him? Yeah, he did. They called him all kinds of names. Jesus didn't strike back. They hurled insults at him while he's hanging there on the cross. Jesus didn't curse them back. He paid the price. It's interesting. The Bible says, he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, threatened not, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. Now the thought occurs to me that maybe this verse is talking about what Jesus was talking about in the Sermon on the Mount. He said, if somebody slaps you in the right cheek, what do you do? Oh, wow. I thought you were going to say, slap him back. I perceive I'm with a bunch of Christians tonight. That's nice. And if somebody compels you to go a mile, what do you do? Go the second mile. Why? Because that's where the real joy of living is. Not much joy in doing what you can do or what you ought to do. The joy is in doing what you're thrilled to do, what you're privileged to do, which is beyond what anyone else would have actually expected from you. So I wonder if sometimes people don't suffer wrong and they go home and they pray, God, I know you're going to take care of me. It's no fun to be mistreated like I've been mistreated, have people run all over me. But I want to be your people. I want to be like you. So help me. But I'm not going to fight back. All right, verse 7, please.
Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and the late rains.
Okay, so the subject that's introduced in this verse is patience, right? So you're going to talk about patience in a couple of three verses here. Is patience needed during the time that the rich are oppressing the righteous?
Yes.
Absolutely. How long is the Christian to be patient? Yeah, until the coming of the Lord. Might that be a long time? Might that be our lifetime? Could very well be. Will Christians be vindicated on the day of judgment? Yes. How does James illustrate the patience needed by Christians? Yeah, the farmer. You know, he hopes for rain. Does sometimes he have to wait a long time for it? Sometimes he gets more rain he wants. He hopes for the sunshine. Does he sometimes have to be patient waiting for that? Well, I'll tell you, if there's anyone that ought to believe in the Lord, it ought to be the farmer. I mean, he really depends upon God, doesn't he? For the sunshine and the rain and favorable weather conditions, because his whole crop is going to be dependent upon that. Now, is long-suffering a pretty good way to describe patience?
Yes.
Oh, I think so. Verse 8.
You choose to be patient, strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near.
Now, what encourages patience for the Christian?
The Lord's coming.
The certainty of the Lord's return. Well, in what way does the coming of the Lord enable us to strengthen our hearts?
Because he always keeps his promises.
That's true. We know how it's all going to turn out in the end. Now, the end hasn't come, and it may seem like we're really being challenged to be patient a long, long time. It may be true. But even if it doesn't happen in our lifetime, we at least know that ultimately that's the way it's going to turn out. Now, question number 3, is it difficult for us to understand that the coming of the Lord is near? It is for me. Because to me, to near would be maybe next week. Certainly not after November. By then, you're beginning to get kind of far off. I'm not meaning to be facetious. But when I talk about something being near, you know, I would say, I don't talk about Easter being near, do you? I sure talk about Thanksgiving being near. Because it's this month. And, you know, this is the way I use the word all the time. When I think, well, I've got something coming up in the near future. And I think that most people, when they hear me use that phrase, think, okay, this is the next few days, maybe. Next few weeks at the most, near future.
In the history of humankind, the church age is the last part.
It certainly is. It certainly is. Yeah. And I have to go revert back to Peter, don't I? I have to go to Peter, 2 Peter chapter 3, and read what he has to say. And there he tells me, wait a minute, I don't keep time the way you do. I know you've got that Timex on your wrist, but I don't keep time that way. 1,000 days with the Lord is what? 1,000 years?
A day.
A day is 1,000 years, right. It just doesn't keep time the same way. Now, in light of eternity, it is near. So it's one of those words that we use, and depends upon the context in which you're using the word as to how you understand the meaning of it. And I'm afraid that a lot of people really misunderstand the phrase, the coming of the Lord is near, because we try to understand the way we use the term rather than the way that God is using the term.
Well, they had the same problem in the early church because they had the people that just would stop working and say that the Lord's going to be coming soon. Why should I bother working doing this?
Exactly right. You're talking about the church in Thessalonica. And Paul said, no work, no eat. Get back to work. And in every generation, there have been those who have stopped work. And they've gone to a certain location because they knew that the Lord's coming in a few days. They want to be there to meet Him. And the Bible says, don't you go looking at any one place. I'm glad I lived long enough to see television. Because now I realize that what happens in China, we can know about the same day they know about it. We got these satellites out there and they beam all these pictures to us. And we see our president of Indonesia talking to the people there. And we can hear him almost the same time he's doing the talking. So God had this figured out long before television came into being. So if you wonder, how can Christ be seen by everybody in the world when we live on opposite sides? No problem for God.
You know, Glenn, it occurs to me as I read this verse, it's not what the verse is talking about, but I think anybody applies. We can just think of be patient and strengthen your hearts because the Lord is near. He's always near us anyway, in a different sense. But I think that perhaps that just encourages us to be this way all the time.
Yeah. He's always with us, isn't it? Last verse of Matthew makes that clear. Does the example of Abraham give us reason to be patient? What tested patience of Abraham? Birth of that son. How old was he when his son was finally born? 100. How old was Sarah? Pretty old. Is our faith being tested each day as we await the return of the Lord? Yes, it is. Now, verse 9.
Do not complain, brethren, against one another, so that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door.
Does the impatience with God sometimes lead to impatience with God's people?
Yes.
Afraid so. Is there a tendency to blame others when things aren't going our way?
Of course.
It's not our fault.
Boy, talk about complaining. He said, don't do it. But we do it all the time. Too bad. If we have a fault against a brother, rather than complain about that and blab it to everybody, what does the Bible say we ought to do? Go to that person. One-on-one. What if that doesn't work? Go again. Take somebody with you. What if that doesn't work? Bring it to the congregation. Yeah. That's Matthew 18, verses 15 through 20. That's the biblical way to deal with that. And by the way, remember, in God's plan there, who takes the initiative? The one who has been hurt. The one against whom a complaint has been leveled. It's so easy for us to say, that person needs to apologize to me. No, you need to go to them. You go to them and talk it over with them. We don't do it that way. Furthermore, we reverse the whole procedure, don't we? We usually tell the whole community before we ever talk to a person one-on-one. Does a lack of patience lead to complaining? I think that it does. Is the fact that God will judge all men a reason for us to be patient and not to try to do what God is going to do? Yes, because our complaining is not going to solve any of the problem. As an example, brethren, of suffering and patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Who are role models for Christians in the matter of suffering and patience? Read for me Matthew 5, verses 11 and 12.
Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you.
Yes. So the prophets become our role models, don't they? Tell me, what's the name of a prophet that comes to your mind when you think of somebody who suffered and yet was patient in their suffering? Any prophets come to your mind?
Jeremiah.
I'm sorry?
Jeremiah.
A classic example. Cast down in that dungeon, dirty, damp dungeon. I mean, he was sinking in the mire. He was dying a slow death if somebody didn't come to the rescue. Fortunately, somebody did. But, he certainly suffered and had to be patient. Another example would be Micaiah. Now, be honest with me. How many of you can tell me the story of Micaiah? Anybody? A couple of you can. Do you remember King Ahab and Jezebel? You know who they are, don't you? Isn't it interesting who we remember and who we don't? Okay. Sorry about that. Ahab, now, had lost some property to the Assyrians. And the day he finally came, he got a lot of it back, but he didn't get back Ramoth-Gilead. And he was visited by Jehoshaphat, who at that time was the king of the southern kingdom. Ahab's king of the northern kingdom. And Jehoshaphat and Ahab had children that married each other. So there's some tie in there. Now, I don't know exactly why Jehoshaphat was visiting Ahab on this occasion. But it was an occasion which Ahab could say, you know, we've never really been able to repossess Ramoth-Gilead that belongs to us. It's up there in the control of the Arameans. You reckon you could get your forces to go along with us so we could take back this territory that belongs to us? And he said, well, I think we probably could. He said, don't you think we ought to seek the counsel of the prophets of God? And Ahab said, well, okay, we can do that. So Ahab called in 400 prophets. Were the 400 prophets in agreement? They were. And what was their answer? Sure, piece of cake. No, they didn't say that. But they said, yeah, you'll get it. No, no problem. Go on ahead and take it. Jehoshaphat is a man that I think must have had a little bit of keen insight built into his system. Because when he saw all 400 of them so quickly agree with the king, I think he thinks, hey, has he been greasing the palm? Has he been paying these guys off? And so Jehoshaphat said, is there any other prophet? And said, yeah, one. Well, let's talk to him. I don't like to talk to him. Why? Because he never tells me what I want to hear him say. Well, let's listen to him. He was in jail. Micaiah was. Suffering for being a prophet of God. They bring him out of jail. But the one man who's sent to get him in the jail says, you need to know the 400 prophets have already said it's okay to go. So you know what you need to say too. And so when Micaiah arrives on the scene, they say, okay, shall we go? And he said, why, sure. And Ahab thought, now wait a minute, I don't like your tone of voice. Was he being sarcastic? Sure he was. And Micaiah said, you don't want me to tell you the truth, but if you're willing to listen to the truth, I'll tell you, you better not go. This is not right. And you know what happened to Micaiah as a result of telling him that? Put him back in jail. And not only in jail, but said, let's mistreat him while he's there too. Now, when we talk about this, You know, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Here's a classic example of a prophet who spoke in the name of the Lord. Is he suffering for it? Yes, he is. So there are many others we could talk about. And the passage in Hebrews talks about that. Somebody has Hebrews 11, verses 36 through 38. Let's read that, and then we'll stop.
Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not welcome to them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and caves and holes on the ground.
Yeah. Pretty gross picture. Pretty vivid picture. Father in heaven, we're humbled when we read verses like we've just heard. And we look at the life that we're living. We've got it made. We've got it so nice. And yet, it may not always be that way. But at least while we are here tonight, and while we are so blessed, we've had good food to eat today. We're wearing good clothes. We're surrounded by wonderful brothers and sisters in Christ. We're in a wonderful building. We live in a great country. Oh, I know that there's a lot of wrong, but there's certainly a lot of right. God, you have blessed us abundantly. Forgive us when we complain. Help us, if need be, to be willing to suffer for you. But in the meantime, control our tongue. Don't let us use our tongue to complain, but rather to use our tongue to sing your praises and to offer you the thanksgiving that comes from our hearts. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen.